2005 with the reality of 24-hour news and the proliferation of the internet and blogs that getting information would not be difficult. Guess again. It seems that more and more journalists are finding it more difficult to inform the public. There are examples in this country and elsewhere that are stunning when you think about it, and we'll shed some light on those, as well as fill in some of the knowledge gaps with my next guest. Tanya Churchmuch is the Canadian president of Reporters Without Borders, an international organization working for freedom of the press throughout the world. She is also a reporter with Global News in Montreal and is the Sunday anchor of their 6 p.m. newscast. She joins me on the line from Montreal this afternoon. Please welcome to the commentary.ca, Tanya Churchmuch. Good afternoon, Ms. Churchmuch.
And good afternoon to you.
The Juliette O'Neill story. She was a reporter with the Ottawa Citizen.
That's correct.
And she was in receipt of some information regarding the Mahar Arar case, right?
That's right.
And the RCMP paid a visit to her house one morning. The reason was that they gave?
Well, what they were doing was using for the very first time Canada's newest anti-terrorist law, C-36, that says that, you know, for the most part, anything that a journalist publishes that may be considered to be suspicious into our own, as they say, I guess, national security, no longer is protected by what is traditionally seen as the way the journalists can protect their sources. And this is the very first time that we have seen this law be applied to a journalist. And it's a little bit dangerous because what happened in the Arar case is that Juliette O'Neill was given some secret documents that just sort of explained the possible connection between the RCMP and the Arar situation. And they wanted to know who leaked the information, and that's why they went into her house, and they wanted to find out who was giving away this information that kind of blew up the story and blew it up in their face. And what has happened so far in that situation is that they went into her home, into her offices, and threatened to arrest her also in regards to this story. However, obviously, her employer immediately challenged the situation, and right now we're sort of in a legal limbo. We have seen some parts of her affidavit and of the warrant into her arrest be made public because, you know, even that was some of that was being hidden. And so right now we're just in a waiting game. It's going to be up to a judge to decide whether or not this was a valid and legal move on the part of the RCMP to go and do this kind of seizure. And until then, we're really not going to know how this new anti-terrorist law is going to continue to affect journalists. If it is seen as acceptable what was done by the RCMP in this case, it'll be a real blow to journalists across Canada. But on the other hand, if the judge says that the RCMP has gone too far in going beyond the lines of the freedom of the press and the rights of Juliette O'Neill to publish information that the population needs to know, then that hopefully will give us a little bit more strength as media workers.
Now, the source is still protected. Where she
that is
it.
Correct.
Right. And if she doesn't reveal the source, the threat of jail, is that a possibility?
Well, right now the RCMP, the last time I spoke with Ms. O'Neill, she just said that, you know, it's just like this sort of hanging question. She says, I don't think it will happen, but they told me that, you know, yes, that is a possibility, and they've never said no again. So she really doesn't know what the situation is, and nobody knows. This is just absolutely uncharted territory for us here in Canada, and I think it's going to be a real long legal process before there's any kind of end to it.
Pardon my ignorance, but C-36, that's anti-terror. That's an anti-terror law, right?
Mm-hmm, that's
and
right.
That was brought in after September 11th, was it?
It was just in the, or it may have even been before that. I'm not sure. It's somewhere around that timing.
And was there any opposition for the bill?
There was opposition, yes. There was opposition from all different kinds of levels, especially from the NDP and some people within the Liberals. But it was pretty much seen that this is just, at the time, time, it was just seen that this was an important thing that had to be done for national security. And I think that there was just a sort of fear that was happening at that time that Canada wasn't doing enough to stop any potential terrorist acts. Now, this is a law that is going to have to be reevaluated again in the next year. I think that was part of what was involved with this whole situation, is that, okay, that we had a three-year time period or four-year time period, and after that it was going to have to be evaluated to see if there would have to be any kind of changes or anything made to it. And so, you know, this is something that will be coming up. But, I mean, there was some opposition, but not enough, obviously, to stop it from becoming law.
It's another one of those, the law of unintended consequences.
Exactly.
Isn't it? Jonathan Alter's Newsweek column from February 28th was entitled "Your Right to Know is Under Attack," and he outlined some shocking examples of freedom of the press being challenged in the United States. The key one was the Judith Miller, Philip Sheehan of the New York Times,
yes,
as well as Matt Cooper of Time. Now, they were, well, the deal was there that they were actually, you'll have to walk me through this. I thought Robert Novak in his syndicated column revealed the identity of Valerie Plame, who was the CIA operative, the wife of Joe Wilson, the ambassador, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why was Ms. Miller and Mr. Sheehan, as well as Mr. Cooper, involved with that? Why didn't they get it, Novak?
Because, well, for this one, because what they were doing, what we were seeing was that for Matthew Cooper, what that was the question of refusal to name their sources in the investigation into who leaked the identity.
I see, okay.
Of the agent, and that's where the problem came in. It wasn't just the leaking of the name of the agent, but where did they get the name from? And that's what people wanted to know. And that one had been a very difficult one, because we had seen that their arrests, there had been the sentences, it had been held up in a court of appeals court on February 16th, but then we had on the February 28th of this, there was a ruling by the U.S. District Judge in Manhattan who recognized the right of Judith Miller and Philip Sheehan to protect the confidentiality of their source. But this is sort of a problem, because it was really only a lower court ruling, and we say that there are other cases that are still pending in regards to confidentiality of sources in the United States. It's a real difficult situation. Right now there's actually about 10 journalists across the country who are being prosecuted for refusing to disclose their sources. And this is something that has just really snowballed, obviously, since September 11th in the United States. But, you know, it's really just a sort of question that, you know, there's the notion of terrorism and national security, but there's also the question of how sometimes people will take laws that perhaps are, you know, have their good intentions, and just abuse them for their own uses afterwards, once that is put into, you know, put down on paper and signed and becomes an enacted law, that there is a lot of abuse that happens. And especially what we're seeing in regards to this anti-terrorism law, we're seeing in countries all around the world, especially in some countries where there has been, you know, difficulties, like somewhere like in the Philippines or in Tibet or Nepal, where they're enacting this sort of, you know, kind of security anti-terrorist laws that, in the end, are just being used to manipulate freedom of the press. And it's a really troubling situation that we have seen since 2001.
Is this, in the American context, is that a political thing? Is that advocating judges? What is that? The snowball,
you know,
that you talk about?
It's a little bit of everything, because it's becoming so across the board now, that it's really just happening a little bit of everywhere and in all kinds of different contexts. So I don't think we can really pigeonhole it and say, okay, it's just one type of, you know, judge that is doing this, or one type of political activist. It's just something that seems to be a growing trend, where there's just a question of, okay, how much right does a journalist have to his sources, which before was pretty much just considered sacrosanct. That it was just something that was not going to be really questioned in that way, and people really had an understanding of how important it was to have these secret sources. Watergate being one of the biggest scandals in American history existed only because there was somebody who was willing to give that information, and people sort of recognized that and saw that as important. And now it's just sort of being attacked in a different direction, where people don't seem to be seeing that the value of what it is, and are just sort of, I'd say, transforming it through these new laws.
Do you think people, regular citizens, do you think they find this interesting? Do you think they're finding this critical, or is it just journalists who are talking about this?
Well, I hope that every sort of general person, especially in the United States, takes this to heart, because this has been a real problem that we have seen in some American media outlets since September 11th, and especially in reporting that we're seeing on the Iraq War and so many other kinds of international policy things, where it is happening more and more often now. We see in some American media outlets the use of American military authorities who refuse to be identified, or secret source within the American military, and all of these kinds of situations where we're seeing so much media coming out that's just talking about these sources who no reader can ever try to verify in any other way, and nobody else can anyways either. And so we're just having to take it on the word that, okay, yeah, this journalist is telling us the truth, and this journalist has done his background or her background research to be able to confirm that this anonymous source is indeed telling us the truth. And we have seen so many stories that have come out that really aren't founded in truth, that were based on these anonymous tips, that we really have to start asking ourselves questions about the veracity of some of these kinds of subjects. And so when we are able to get true documents given to us, like what happened in the O'Neill case or in some of these other cases we're seeing in the States, where we are getting the true information, we can only hope that the general person in the population would see it as important.
And I'm trying to just pardon if this sounds a silly question, but I'm trying to take
No silly questions.
Just taking the sort of the other point of view in terms of secret sources, and do you think that after Watergate, after Deep Throat and Woodward and Bernstein, that journalists perhaps took it for granted that freedom of the press was sacrosanct, that it was untouchable?
I don't know if it's since that time per se. I think that has always been almost like a fundamental foundation of what we consider to be democracy, where we see that in nations where there is a control of media, if you go into any kinds of countries, like say into Cuba or North Korea, true communist countries, the first thing that is done is the control of the media. That is how the regime is able to continue its power. It's by being able to muzzle any kind of opposing voices, and those opposing voices come out in independent media. In a country like Cuba, there is not one independent newspaper, radio show, or television show. In North Korea, there is one radio station that's played 24 hours a day through every home in the city, in the major cities in the country. Even if we look into nations like the Philippines, journalists are regularly assassinated. In the Ivory Coast, in Africa right now, it's absolute bedlam in many, many areas because there's so much civil unrest there. And, I think that people have always considered that freedom of the press and being able to protect sources and to be able to investigate situations in our governments, in our municipal governments, in our provincial governments, and problems within, major companies, things like that. It's always been considered this is part of what makes us a free country. And so, really over the past decades, there have been very few judges that have been willing to go after media outlets, asking them to reveal their sources. It really had just sort of been a general understanding between the greater public, between government, between media, between police officials, that was not something that was done. However, we are seeing more and more of it in these recent years, not only in the United States, but also here in Canada. We had the Hamilton Spectator journalist.
Is that the Tim Peters?
Tim Peters.
Okay.
That's right, who had been asked to divulge a source he had in regards to a story about funding for a nursing home that had been done, almost a decade ago. And he was found in contempt of court. And his office was forced to pay for the amount, the costs of what court would have cost. It was something like $18,000 or something like that. And the only reason he was able to even get out of it is because the person who had been his source eventually fessed up and said, you know, I was the person. But had he not done that, who knows what could have happened to Ken Peters in that context. And then, you know, we have other problems, too, that we're seeing right now in another court in Ontario, where we have the Washington Post, which is appealing a decision that was done last year in regards to a former UN employee who was from an African nation who's now living in Canada, who said that, you know, there was a Washington Post article published a few years ago that is available on the Internet, and so I'm suing them because... but through a court in Ontario, because, you know, it's according to him, it was causing problems with his image or whatever. But, I mean, that's fine. I think that if anybody has any kind of difficulties with anything that's considered incorrect or believed to be incorrect that is published, that they should have the full right to go and pursue that media outlet. However, now we're seeing the situation where this was a posting coming out of Washington from the Washington Post, posting online, but from the Washington Post newspaper, that, you know, if there's going to be any follow-up, in all honesty, I really do believe that it should be done where the Washington Post is published. If we're going to be saying that, you know, the Internet is an area that is open and free game to anybody because anything is available in a country, then we're going to see media outlets that are going to be, you know, frightened to publish things online because they could be followed up by any court that's deemed to be sympathetic, and people can go, you know, if this passes, this appeal, it's not accepted, and the story ends there, then, you know, who knows how many people we could have coming into Ontario, moving into Ontario, and launching these kinds of lawsuits against, you know, people like CNN or BBC or whomever, just because it's available to be seen online in Ontario. And these are the kind of things that we're seeing in Canada right now.
Now, that's the story of, I forget, I'm going to butcher the name, Cheki Bangura?
Exactly.
I found this interesting. The judge ruled that the newspaper should have reasonably foreseen that the story would follow Bangura wherever he resided.
Mm-hmm.
That an editor doesn't put an article on the Internet if he does not wish to reach a large audience. And furthermore, that the more important the potential target, the more editors should take care. Now, that you wrote to Justice Minister Erwin Kotler about that. Have you gotten a response?
We have not received a response yet. No, we have not. Because we wrote a letter in regards to that. Because I think that, you know, there is some reality to what's being said in that by the judge. However, the thing is that if we look at the situation for the Washington Post, as they outlined it, they're saying, you know, more than 90% of their readers are in the Washington City region, that in the province of Ontario they only had 7 people who subscribed to the Washington Post online, and only one of those 7 people had actually paid to see the article that was in question. So we're talking about one single person in the entire province of Ontario who actually went online to see that. And I think that shows, you know, heck, anybody could, you know, leave a newspaper in, you know, in a doctor's room that they picked up on a vacation, you know, and is that going to mean, you know, that what, the doctor will be responsible for that one, you know, newspaper that was found in his office? You know, I think that it just shows that it's just going a little bit too far in that context.
Well, what do you think the public can do? Do we lobby our politicians? Do we write judges? What do we do?
Well, definitely. I think it's very important to lobby the politicians and to write Erwin Kotler and to say, you know, we think it's important that the Canadian government take a public stance on this and to say how they view this. You know, obviously, politicians cannot try and influence a judge. A legal decision is a legal decision, but I think at the same time that politicians can publicly state where they stand on this and what they think is appropriate and what they think is inappropriate. And I think that that the public has the right to know where their elected politicians stand on these kinds of issues.
And I think everybody who's listening to us should pay attention because these are very important issues. And I thank you again. This has been fascinating to listen to you and talk about these things. Reporters Without Borders, your website is rsf.org, right?
That's right.
And thanks, Tanya, for taking the time to talk with us today.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Tanya Churchmuth here on thecommentary.ca. I'm Joseph Leno.